listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Tonight, we have a conversation with a pair of authors, one of which is Miguel Cejuco. According to the 2008 Man Asian Prize panel of judges, his novel Ilustrado possesses formal ambition, linguistic inventiveness, and socio-political insight in the most satisfying measure. Brilliantly conceived and stylishly executed, it covers a large and tumultuous historical period with seemingly effortless skill. It is also ceaselessly entertaining, frequently raunchy, and effervescent with humor. Miguel Cejuco was born and raised in the Philippines, part of the peripatetic million-strong Filipino diaspora. He has temporarily alighted to Montreal. The manuscript of his debut novel, Ilustrado, won the 2008 Man Asian Literary Prize earlier that year. It was awarded the Polanco Award, the Philippines' highest literary honor. Ilustrado has been published since and is available in the lobby after the program this evening. In conversation with Miguel tonight is Cecilia Manguera Brainerd, the award-winning author and editor of some 20 books, including the internationally acclaimed novel When the Rainbow Goddess Wept, Woman with Horns and Other Stories, and most recently a collection of stories edited by Cecilia for young adults entitled Growing Up Filipino 2, More Stories for Young Adults, which just garnered much praise in a review in the School Library Journal. Growing Up Filipino 2 is on sale in the lobby as well. Cecilia teaches at UCLA Extension's Creative Writing Program. This evening's conversation will be followed by a Q&A. We'll have a microphone floating around, and we ask that you wait for the microphone to ask your question as we record for podcast, and we also want to hear you. And then we'll end the program with a book sale in the lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in silencing our cell phones, pagers, and other would-be noisemakers, and in welcoming Miguel Cejuco and Cecilia Manguera Brainerd to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out today. It's really great to be here. The thing is, you know, I became a writer because I have a phobia of speaking in front of large crowds. So I hope you'll go gently with me and laugh at all my jokes. That was a joke. Come on. So I'm going to read from the beginning of my book, Ilustrado, from the prologue. The panther lurks no longer in foreign shadows. He's come home to rest. Crispin Salvador's fitting epitaph, by his request, is merely his name. From an unattributed obituary, The Philippine Sun, February 12, 2002. When the author's life of literature and exile reached its unscheduled terminus that anonymous February morning, he was close to completing the controversial book we'd all been waiting for. His body, floating in the Hudson, had been hooked by a Chinese fisherman. His arms, battered, open to a virginal dawn. Christ-like, one blog back home reported, sarcastically. Ratty-banded briefs and Hermenegildo Zegna trousers were pulled around his ankles, both shoes lost. A crown of blood embellished the high forehead, smashed by crowbar or dockpile or chunk of frozen river. That afternoon, as if in a dream, I stood in the brittle cold outside the yellow police tape surrounding the entrance of my dead mentor's West Village apartment. The rumors were already milling. The NYPD had found the home in disarray. Plainclothes detectives filled many evidence bags with strange items. Neighbors reported having heard shouts into the night. The old lady next door said her cat had refused to come out from under the bed. The cat, she emphasized, was a black one. Investigators quickly declared there was no evidence of foul play. You may recall seeing the case in the news, though the coverage was short-lived during the months following September 11, 2001. Only much later, during lulls in the news cycle, was Salvador mentioned at any length in the Western media. A short feature in the arts section of the New York Times, a piece in Le Monde on anti-colonial expatriates who lived in Paris, and a negligible reference at the end of a Village Voice article about famous New York suicides. After that, nothing. At home in the Philippines, however, Salvador's sudden silencing was immediately autopsied on both sides of the political divide. Both the Philippine Gazette and the Sun traded blows with Salvador's own Manila Times, debating the author's literary and indeed social significance to our weary country. The Times, of course, declared their dead columnist the waylaid hope of a culture's literary renaissance. The Gazette argued that Salvador was not an authentic Filipino writer because he wrote mostly in English and was not browned by the same sun as the masses. The Sun said Salvador was too middling to merit murder. Suicide, each of the three papers concluded, was a fitting resolution. When the news emerged of the missing manuscript, every side discarded any remaining equipoise. The legend of the unfinished book had persisted for over two decades, and its loss reverberated more than its author's death. Online, the blogosphere grew gleeful with conjecture as to its whereabouts. The literati, the career journalists foremost among them, abandoned all objectivity. Many doubted the manuscript's existence in the first place. The few who believed it was real dismissed it as both a social and personal poison. Almost everyone agreed that it was tied to Crispin's fate. And so each trivial tidbit dredged up during the death investigation took on significance. Gossip cycloned among the writing community that Salvador's pipe was found by the police, its contents still smoking. A rumor circulated that he long ago fathered and abandoned a child, and he'd been maddened by a lifetime of guilt. One reputable blog, in an entry titled Annus Horribilis, claimed extra virgin olive oil was found leaking out of the corpse's rectum. Another blog surmised that Salvador was not dead at all. Dead or alive, wrote Plaridel 3000, who would know the difference? None among Salvador's colleagues and acquaintances, he had no real friends anymore, questioned the suicide verdict. After 2 weeks of conjecture, everyone was happy to forget the whole thing. I was unconvinced. No one knew what I knew. So we'll talk about the book now.
Thank you, Miguel. It was very nice. I wanted to talk to you first about the book, the genesis. How long it took you to write, the long journey from beginning to when it started to get awards and now published and getting rave reviews.
Sure, okay. The book is about Crispin Salvador, as you know, who was found in the Hudson, and missing from his apartment is a manuscript, and his young student Miguel decides to return to the Philippines to investigate. And Miguel encounters a country in absolute turmoil. Elections are imminent. Politicians are jockeying for power. Religious leaders are trying to be kingmakers. A storm is brewing. There are explosions in the south, in southern cities. And Miguel discovers that, you know, this book is just as much his own as it is, or the story is his own as much as it is his dead mentor's. And so what I've done with this is that I've recreated the life's work of Crispin Salvador through a wide array of excerpts from Crispin's life's work. So we have memoir, essays, interviews, short story excerpts, excerpts from his novels. There are dirty jokes, if that appeals to you guys. I think it might. So I put in everything I could. There are text messages, you know, email, interviews, all that sort of stuff. And the reason I did this was because I had this idea some years ago. I was a a fact checker, a freelance fact checker at the Paris Review in 2004. And I was fact checking their Writers at Work series. And so, say, for example, I was fact checking this interview with Jack Kerouac. I found myself in the library stacks going through all of the you know, literary writing of Kerouac, memoirs, academic studies about his work, interviews, etc. And while I was doing that, I thought, wow, this is really interesting. This is a neat way, and a very modern way, I think, of creating the portrait of the artist.
So 2004 was when you started to get the idea to do something like this.
To write something that pulls from many disparate sources to create one cohesive whole. And that's where I got the idea. And then I started doing a PhD in creative writing at the University of Adelaide. I was living in Australia at the time. And I because this was my first novel, I'd never written one before, I thought, well, okay, I mean, I'll just write. And so I was starting to write a very linear, conventional narrative, because that's what I was familiar with, hoping to maybe pull in excerpts and snippets from Crispin's work to add color or texture to the whole novel. And it wasn't working. I'd written a 200,000 word, you know, that thick. I pitied my poor PhD supervisor because he had to read every draft of it. And I was ashamed. I mean, it was horrible. Even I didn't want to read it, let me put it
in
that way.
In this linear draft, your main character was Crispin.
Crispin, yes, exactly. Okay. And I had all of these little stories that I was working through from Crispin's work. And one day I was watching television. I was watching a documentary on weavers in the south part of the Philippines, in Mindanao. And I saw how these ladies created these textiles, which have patterns, you know, bahags or table runners, as we use them now in the Philippines, or different types of patterns. But how they started was they first wove the thread by hand, separately. Mm-hmm. And then they fed those different threads into the loom. And when I saw that image, something just kind of clicked in my head. And I thought, wow, this is the way I have to write my story. So I went, I rushed to the computer, I opened up 10 different Microsoft Word documents, and I teased out all the different narrative threads and assigned them their own document and developed those, knowing that 90% of everything that I wrote would just end up on the cutting room floor, but somehow would resonate within the book.
All right.
And so I developed all of those threads, and then when I had everything, a substantial amount, I wove them together to create patterns. Now, the book is unconventional. It asks something of the reader. It asks for you to be engaged and to give it a chance. Because I don't have the typical Aristotelian plot structure of the, you know, problem, rising action, solution, you know, that pyramid that we all learn about in school. What drives this are thematic elements, revolution, exile, and duty, for example, either filial duty or a duty as a Filipino, literature, heroism, all of these different themes that are threaded through all of the different narrative threads. And they recur throughout all these different separate narrative threads. And that's what gives the novel, at least I wanted it to, a sense of cohesiveness.
It feels like a mystery too on some level, you know, the unfolding of this, what is this dead body all about?
Yes.
And then the young, his protege then going out and trying to find a missing novel, trying to get find a missing daughter and so on. So there's also that mystery element. But it's
starts
deeper
off
than
as
that.
A mystery because, you know, a dead body is always interesting, I think. It's undeniable. You can't overlook a dead body at the beginning of a book. But then it devolves or evolves into the greater mysteries of life. So it starts off as a murder mystery and then it becomes, well, something I think a lot more.
At what point did you submit, or what happened with this Palanca Award? How did that happen? So you're working on a manuscript and there was something now and it was sent to Palanca?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Palanca Award is for unpublished manuscripts, as was the Man Asian. The thing is, that was in 2008 when I won those awards, but let's go back to 2007. I applied for the same award with the same book, and it didn't win. It didn't get on the long list even. So I thought, well, okay, and then obviously, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. So I went home and I took the book apart. Okay. I cut characters, I polished, I tied up loose ends. And
did they give you some feedback at all? No, did you get an idea as to why it... Okay.
No, they never do. They never do.
Might have a
friend. I wish they would. No, I have no friends.
All right. Now you do. You have friends then. All right.
Only because I'm buying drinks, you know. I worked a whole year on the book, and I changed it, and it was a totally different book, and I submitted it in 2008. And much to my surprise, it won the Palanca. And then it got on the long list of the Man Asian Prize. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. After spending years, literally years, querying agents, literary agents to find representation to get me a publisher, I used to wallpaper my wall with rejection slips because I read that F. Scott Fitzgerald did that. forgetting, of course, that he went crazy. Right?
And this was, you were doing this from Australia, were you?
In Australia and then in Montreal where I moved. I moved to Montreal because my girlfriend was going to school there. She's Australian.
All right.
And so it was hard. And I got on the long list. I thought, wow, great. So now agents maybe will return my emails and my letters. And then I got on the short list. I even remember when the night the long list was to be announced, I sat in front of the computer. They're going to announce it 12 noon Hong Kong time, so 12 o'clock New York time. I was in
listening.
New York. No, I was sitting there pressing refresh repeatedly, refresh, 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 obsessively. And then I saw my name on the long list, and I cried. I wept, you know, and I thought everything would change. And then the short list, I thought, I'm not even getting on the short list. I don't even want to hope. And of course, again, refresh, refresh, refresh that evening for the short list, and I got on the short list. And I thought, great, I'm going to get the free trip to Hong Kong. I'm going to eat a lot of Chinese food. I'm going to get wasted at the event. I had to buy myself a tuxedo because I knew everyone would be showing up in their $1,000 tuxedos. But I was on a scholarship, and I was poor for so many years. I ended up buying a $60 secondhand tuxedo from the 70s. I think it was a ladies' because it was too short for me. I had to have it taken out. And I show up in my $60 tuxedo, and I won. And I cried, as one does. And everything just changed for me after that. One of the judges referred their literary agent to me. And within less than a week, I had a literary agent. Ah. And in less than 2 weeks, I had a book deal.
That's amazing. And just,
yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that agents and publishers don't accept unsolicited manuscripts normally, unless they're young and trying to build a list, or they're just, you know, they're a different level.
Or won an award.
Well, that's the thing, is that, yeah, I mean, yeah. I'll always wonder if the book is out because I won the award or because it got into the hands of the right people. It depends, you know, I have my days where...
Maybe both.
Maybe, yeah.
Lucky and, you know, and good.
Right.
It helps. The book has gotten really tremendous reviews. Book list is a starred review for Publishers Weekly, starred review for Library Journal, starred review for Kirkus. I just love Kirkus too. And you had discussed a little bit about it, Miguel, but I wanted to just read an excerpt of the Kirkus review. Just because I think it kind of captures what you had started to describe about the non-linearness of the novel, the non-traditional form that in fact makes it very interesting. He tells his story in both the first and third persons, mixing fictional reality with dreams and excerpts from both Salvador's work and his own work in progress, Biography of Salvador. The novel ultimately blurs the distinction between life and art, between protege and mentor, within what it calls arbitrary scrimb between fiction and nonfiction. And at the end of the review, it says, first novels rarely show such rich reach and depth. And the reviews just keep coming. I bet How do you feel? I mean, that must be just so heady when you get those reviews.
Of course. It's scary. You know, I think, oh my God, there's a review coming out, and then the review comes out and it's good, and you think, oh my God, what are they smoking? Can I have some of that? And I'm incredulous. I'm frankly incredulous. It's a dream come true. I'm pinching myself all the time. But then I go and sit down at my desk and I try to write something new. I write a short story or I write even an email that I'm trying to... And it's writing is still the hardest thing I've ever done.
Okay. That's good to know.
Oh, yeah. And it just brings
it
you...
It isn't,
you
know, easy.
It is heady. You're like a balloon coming up, and then all of a sudden you sit down and you write, and it's as if someone just popped you and you come onto the floor.
Do you have a schedule? Do you work every day? Or what? I know you're running around right now promoting the book, but when things are kind of normal...
Well, now I'm promoting it, begging people to buy it, because I've done all these odd jobs. I was a medical guinea pig. You know, I was painted houses, and I'm just, please buy my book so that I can get married and, you know, be happy. So, this year is basically promoting, but... when I am writing, I treat it like a day job. It's, you know, 9 to 5.
All right.
I set deadlines for myself.
Did you always do that?
I always did. And okay, my other jobs were hobbies that paid. Or basically, it wasn't writing was the hobby and my jobs were the living. This was my living, even though I didn't make any money from it.
All right.
And so what I do is I would set myself a deadline and I will work, say, a month straight. No holidays, no weekends, because I don't want to lose this thread. I don't want to lose that momentum. And then I'll take 2 weeks off so that I can come back to the book with fresh eyes.
Do you work? You critique your own work, or do you workshop it, or do you have friends to look at it?
I've got
feedback?
A good friend. I believe in workshopping. I mean, writing is essentially communicating, right? It's like learning a language. My learning how to write is like learning how to... I'm trying to learn to speak French now. It's the same thing. And you need to be out there. You need to have people correcting you. You need to listen to yourself speak, and you need to study other things. So I have friends who I workshop with. They workshop my work. I workshop theirs. And then now, recently, because I'm now with Farah Strauss and Giroux, I have an editor who helps me. Wonderful guy in New York named Eric Chinsky, whose wife happens to be Filipina.
Oh, that's good.
So it was, serendipity for me.
Connection.
Yeah.
Right. Novelists will sometimes talk about the central image in their novel, and I don't know if you feel you have a central image. Do you feel you have a central image, Miguel, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many central images.
All right. I know there are a lot of really strong images in there. I thought maybe you could share with us a favorite image or a strong image or something you consider very important. Maybe perhaps talk to us.
Okay, so I'll read it over there so you don't see my legs quaking. Seriously, I always get nervous reading my own work. One more thing, Crispin said. One last story. He stared at the typewriter in front of him. When you get to my age, the most insignificant memories take on significance, he said. Unrationalized blame, casual kindnesses, random gestures. One day you just need to tell someone about them. There was this time when I was a boy when my father was consumed by jealousy. I had already gotten on my parka and backpack, and I was sitting there listening to Crispin. I cradled the bundle of outgoing mail in one arm, but he continued. Papa had always coveted the zoo my uncle had on his farm, so he decided to get an animal of his own, but for our house in Manila. He wanted to impress my mother, as well as coax her into spending more time with him there than in Bacolod, Crispin said. I poured him a glass of sherry. He looked up at me and nodded. He continued. Of course, my father didn't know anything about animals. He just liked having them. He must have thought he could hire people, as one does. He wanted a tiger, and somehow he got one. I don't know how. I was too young. I remember he kept it in a cage by the swimming pool, near the lanai where we had our meals when we ate outdoors. Actually, I think the tiger was there in Forbes Park, because it was being transported to the farm that we had at Swanee. I'm not sure anymore. Crispin sipped his sherry. He still hadn't changed out of his ruined barong, the Philippine national dress. Two black manuscript boxes were on the floor beside him. I leaned on the door jamb and looked at my watch. Madison would be waiting at home with Valentine's Day dinner. This morning, to my dismay, she'd told me about finding a recipe for tofu Peking duck, and I still had somehow to find some sort of gluten-free hoisin sauce. It had come to feel like our relationship counted on the successful fulfillment of such errands. I undid my scarf and unzipped my coat. Anyhow, Crispin continued, at that time it was a big tiger to me. Huge. I think it must have been an adolescent, because the space by the swimming pool and the lanai wasn't that big. Doesn't everything seem bigger when looking back? Well, I can only imagine what the neighbors thought. What arrogance! A tiger in your garden. Ha! Truly. Thing is, the damn thing wouldn't eat. It was traumatized by the flight or the truck or however it had been transported. It was a mess. I'm not sure whether it was a he or a she or what became of it. It lay against whichever corner of the cage didn't have sun. The cage was barely large enough for it to pace and turn. Crispin looked at the manuscript piled in its open box beside his typewriter. He went on. One time my father had us eating breakfast outside to appreciate the tiger. This part I remember well. We didn't want to because it smelled bad, sour and musky. But we had no choice. We sat there pushing the food around our plates. Mama was reading her pocketbook mystery. My father was in a good mood, and he picked up a few bacon strips and approached the animal. How macho! He wanted to feed it by hand. But the poor animal was afraid. It cowered in the corner. Papa got angry and started shouting at it. I'll never forget what he said. He yelled, "What kind of king of the jungle are you?" Crispin laughed heartily and then sighed. "Yes, it's funny now," he said. "But at the time, my brother and sister and I were terrified by the whole thing. The sadness was only felt later. You know how it is. My father threw the bacon at the tiger and hit it in the face. This puddle of piss formed under the animal, like some fluorescent toxic spill. I can see it like it was yesterday. The tiger cowering in its urine. Papa standing over it screaming. Mama still reading. We children averting our eyes, watching flies land on sliced mango on the fine china in front of us." Crispin rearranged his ashtray and meerschaum pipe, moved the decanter to the left, placed the matching glass beside it. He stared at what his hands were doing, watching with absolute disinterest in their tasks. "I remember telling this story," he said, "years later to my girlfriend, Gigi. It was odd. I hadn't remembered it for 20 years until I recounted it to her. I wept after, the first time since childhood. Gigi told me our country needs a revolution. Of course she'd say that. She's French. It took me even longer to understand that in our country, revolution isn't parricide. It's deicide. I finally think our redemption will have to be more noble than that. Anyway, I always wanted to use my memory of that tiger for a short story or a scene in a novel. But some things are better kept in the past." Crispin pulled the paper from his typewriter, added it to the manuscript, and closed the box. He put the box on top of the other two. "After I wept," he said, "I remember how clear my eyes were." Crispin looked at me. I'll never forget how he looked at me, as if I was a holy ghost, as if he realized what had to happen. "So long," he said, with his shy smile. "Keep it bouncing." And I went home to Madison, the screaming of the living room smoke alarm, windows wide open, and an apartment as cold as the winter outside. And that was the last time I spoke with Crispin. Thanks.
So, tell us why this particular image is important to you, or why it's special to you.
Well, you know, the idea of the aristocracy, you know, these moneyed people in the Philippines doing these crazy things with impunity, but at the same time, it's also the tiger is almost a metaphor for many of the characters I have in my book. You know, they're caged and scared and confused, not knowing where they're going. Mm-hmm. You know, in the book, you know, by society, by the responsibilities they have, by their own worst tendencies and best hopes. So this idea of an animal caged and cowering, yeah, I don't know. To me, that's a metaphor for many things in the book.
And Philippine society, yeah. It seems. There's something interesting that happens in your book, or at least to me, because the pieces, and we've discussed it's how nonlinear it is, and it's a non-traditional form. Actually, what I get out of it is that the feeling of it is like I'm visiting the Philippines. It feels like a literary representation of that society.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
So, you know, I mean, like, there's so many things going on in the Philippines. You got the coup d'etat, you got this, you got, you know, a pimp over there. Just all kinds of things. And you get that. And so I like that very much. So, I mean, the form is very much part of the novel. It is, you know, it's a big part of the novel.
Yeah, and it always was for me. I don't think that my novel is one of those books that just plays with form for the sake of being clever. There were some clear issues that I was dealing with as a Filipino writer. Excuse me. Some of the issues that I've seen with some Philippine writing is that, you know, we have a tendency towards self-exoticization. You know, sunlight, the color of mangoes, earth, the color of tamarind, a water buffalo somewhere in the background in a rice paddy. And I wanted to write against that. We also have a tendency towards didacticism. Because we have a very small reading public back home, we know that we'd like to be read by the world, so we have a tendency towards explaining the little nuances and the complexities of our society. And sometimes in regular, straight narrative fiction, that comes off as a little bit explainy. You have the exoticized, and you have the explainy. And I wanted to figure out how to do all those things, because we are an exotic country. There are strange images like this tiger that happened, but I didn't want to devolve into magical realism or whatever. And I also wanted to explain, you know, this book charts 150 years of Philippine history, but how do I do that without being didactic? And so I thought, well, I guess form is probably the best way for me to do this. By making it fragmented in this way, by allowing me to write blog entries, academic essays, conversations, interviews, I'm allowed to use these forms that are inherently didactic to explain without putting the reader off. And further, because I was drawing from Crispin's work, I was able to parody or satirize many of these, you know, our tendency towards self-exoticization and these tropes and these clichés through his work. In fact, one of my favorite bits is he's got this crime novel called Manila Noir, and it's crime writing, and it's schlocky and it's cheap, it's glorious in that way. I love it. It was my favorite thing to write, and I think readers enjoy it because it's a guilty pleasure. But I was able to indulge in all of those things, and you know, I mean, I really believe that even though this novel might seem unconventional in terms of, you know, it not being like, you know, A Passage to India, which is what one agent said I should read and get back to her because she didn't like my unconventional book. Today, you know, how do we find out about things that are happening, right? You know, like the volcano or the flood in Tennessee. You know, we get it all off the internet. We see a news ticker. We get it on text message. We overhear it in the elevator, people talking about it. We get it sometimes from the newspapers, email or what. And so to me, this is a very organic way of understanding our reality. And so why not write a novel in that way? So to me, this unconventional form, isn't so unconventional.
But what is interesting was that actually it was not, I'm not hearing that it was a conscious choice. I'm hearing you tried to make it linear, and it didn't work, and then you had to go with it was telling you what it wanted to be. Your story was dictating to you it ought to be.
Because I wasn't addressing the solutions, or I wasn't finding the solutions to the problems
Me, that's the magical part of writing a story, when it is telling you what it wants to be instead of you imposing the form. Another thing I wanted to mention that's really fascinating about, you just said something about how you didn't want it to be this magic realism kind of thing. And Filipinos have this fascination with magic realism. And everybody always wants to write like Gabriel Garcia Marquez or, you know, Isabel Allende and so on. I think she's coming here next week. But actually, what is quite fascinating here, and I don't know if you're aware of it, we talked a little bit about it, is that it seems to me that the form you've done here is very similar to a form that is used by Latin Americans, fragmented novel or whatever it is, Juan Rulfo and so on. And I think it's just fascinating because I think that was also a response, that way of writing was a response to that society. And if this is coming out as a response to our society, to me that's just fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I think it is.
An academic could have fun with that.
And it also responds to the literature that preceded it.
Right.
In a sense, you know, we're always inspired or writing in reaction to our forefathers and foremothers, you know, our forebears. And I am trying to create Philippine society in a way, and I think fragmented is the best way to do it because we are fragmented.
Real quick, what do you think of Philippine or Philippine-American literature? Do you consider yourself a Filipino writer? How do you perceive yourself? How do you fit? What some thoughts on that? And then I'm going to ask you to read. Why don't you read us one of your dirty jokes? It sounds like fun.
Okay, well, I'll have to look for that. I'm nothing if not Filipino, and I'd like to be a writer one day. I'm still learning. So one day I hope to be a Filipino writer, but at the same time, I was talking to Rodrigo Fresan, who's an Argentinian writer recently. We were doing a panel together in New York. And he says, I was born in Argentine, but I want to die a writer.
I
think that's the whole point. And Jessica Hagedorn was my professor, the great Filipino novelist. And I remember when I first arrived at the master's program, I was writing all this very patriotic, jingoistic stuff. You know, anti-American imperialism, you know, and Filipino nationality, all those things.
Cut that out, Miguel.
Well, that's the thing. She took, and the thing is, all the other workshop mates, you know, they didn't know how to react to this, so they didn't say anything, and they thought it was good. And Jessica took me aside, and she said, stop trying to be a Filipino writer. Be a writer who happens to be Filipino. And that just changed my life, and it just, so simple. It makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that. Yeah.
So what do you think is happening now at Philippine Lit or Philippine American Lit? Do you think good things are happening, or do we have a lot of problems, or what do you think? We have a lot of writers now.
We do have a lot of writers, and
expats as well as in the Philippines.
And I think more and more we're coming out of our shells and trying to publish in larger and larger journals and magazines and applying for prizes and stuff. You know, the Man Asian Literary Prize, every year there are at least, you know, three or four Filipinos on it. We're always very well represented right after the Indians. And I think that attests to the strength of our literary tradition. It's just that, you know, we have to come out of our shell a little bit more. Okay. So hold on.
So now we have our dirty joke.
Yeah, if I can find it.
And afterwards, we go to Q&A, so you can start thinking about questions for Miguel.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit while I find the dirty joke?
Let me see. What should I talk about? Here. I'll read to you. Book list. Dazzling. It is a virtuoso display of imagination and wisdom, particularly remarkable from a 31-year-old author. Did you find your spot?
Yeah, I found my spot. Yeah, enough of that. So I've included jokes. Crispin and Miguel have this thing where they pass each other notes with jokes. And they're old corny jokes from Philippine pop culture, because in a sense it was Cecilia who pointed out to me, and this is exactly what I was going for. It's folklore. It's our way of explaining ourselves, of laughing at ourselves.
And it's very much part of the culture, of Filipino culture.
So this is, this is a snippet from the back. I remember the last joke I shared with Crispin. Boy Bustos' daughter, Girly, asks her father, "Daddy, what is politics?" Boy is very proud of her inquisitiveness. As he's gotten older, spent and rebuilt the small inheritance his father earning left him, risen in politics, watched his daughter grow, witnessed his son being born, seen his marriage shed its glitter, he's realized that our greatest doom is to raise children who repeat our mistakes. This, he knows, is something he doesn't want. He says, "Well, Girly girl, let me explain it this way. First, I'm the head of the family, so you can call me the president. Your mom makes the rules, so we can call her the government. We're here to take care of your needs, so we can call you the people. Your yaya, the nanny, Indai, works for us, and we pay her for her work, so we'll call her the working class. And your baby brother, Junior, let's call him the future." Now think about that and see if that makes sense. Girly goes to bed, pondering what she's heard. In the middle of the night, Girly awakens. She hears baby brother Junior crying, so she checks and discovers he's totally crapped in his pants, in his diaper. Girly goes to her parents' room to find her mother fast asleep. Unable to wake her because of the sleeping pills taken every night, Girly goes to her yaya's room. The door, however, is locked. Girly peeks through the keyhole and sees her father in bed with Indai. Girly goes back to bed. At the breakfast table the next morning, Girly tells her father and mother, "Daddy, Mommy, I think I understand politics now." Boy is proud. "Wow," he exclaims, "you really are sharp. Explain to us in your own words how politics works." "Well," Girly begins, the president is really fucking the working class. And the government doesn't do anything except sleep and sleep. Nobody ever pays attention to the people. And the future, well, the future swims in shit. And see what I've done with this? That story is it's an ongoing saga. So Boy Bustos kisses his daughter proudly on the head. Eventually, Girly grows up. She marries the prominent attorney Araiko and becomes the country's most popular economist, senator, and then vice president. When the president at the time is ousted by yet another EDSA revolution, Girly succeeds him. As she takes the presidential oath of office, she remembers all the wise lessons she's learned from her iconoclastic father, Boy, and the legacy of her industrious grandfather, Erning. President Girly Bustos Araiko becomes the hope of the country. The end, however, proves that the joke's on us. And we all know the punchline. Thanks.
So I think at this point we'll open it up to questions and from the audience. So whoever wishes to ask Miguel anything.
This is the hard part.
We'll start here and then we'll get to Prasi. Oh, I think there's a mic coming in. Mention your name if.
My name is Jenilyn.
Hi, Jenilyn.
And I have two questions for you. I hope you don't mind.
For me or for Cecilia? I was hoping for her.
I guess I just wanted to know to what extent is Miguel Cejuco the character? You. How much of yourself did you infuse in the character Miguel Cejuco?
Sure. None whatsoever. He's a figment of my imagination. But I think I'm the Miguel Cejuco, the author, is in all of the characters. The reason I chose to name my character Miguel Cejuco is to keep the reader a little bit more off balance, to always be wondering what is real and what is not. Because if Miguel is real, and maybe this is, taken from his life, then maybe Crispin is real, which is what I had hoped to accomplish. And then, therefore, maybe everything that's written about the Philippines is real. And then at the end of the book, I'd like to think that the reader realizes, the answer to that question of what is real and what is not. And the short answer is, it doesn't matter.
Okay, for my second question, you did try to explain and say that eventually, at the end of your career, your aspiration is to be a global or a writer, period, and not necessarily a Filipino writer. But what is your aspiration for the novel? You know, what kind of impact do you want the novel to have back home? I think I caught like a YouTube video of you either being introduced to, a body of writers back in the Philippines, and you said, you know, you couldn't wait for the politicians to read it.
Damn YouTube.
You're in a list now, Miguel.
Yeah, I'm blacklisted. That's great. The great thing, though, is that the wonderful thing is that the Philippine consulates were supposed to help me with the book. They were supposed to actually host the launch. And then they received the book, and they said, no, sorry, we can't host the launch. And then I thought, great, I'm on the right track. A novel should have grievances because there are so many grievances in the world. And, you know, I mean, I'd like to be able to speak truth to power in a sense, but, you know, I mean, I have no illusions. I'm writing literary fiction in English. I'm not going to energize the masses to revolt and rise up against the hegemony. You know, I mean, but if I can get people to think a little bit and examine themselves a little bit more about who we are and where we are and where we're going, then maybe I'm doing something possibly meaningful. It was very important for me for the book to come out before the May 10 elections, which are next week. I launched the book 3 weeks ago in the Philippines, and that's where that YouTube video came out. Because if I can just have one person or 5 people or 10 people stop and rethink and think, I'm going to join the nonprofits that watch the elections, or okay, I am going to vote actually because my vote does matter, or I am going to be serious about who I'm choosing and rethink things, then again, I'm doing something a little bit more meaningful. The book is about the Philippines. It's about Philippine politics. It's about our history. It's about all of the complications that have made us, well, who we are and put us in the predicament we're in. And on one level, I hope that it reflects ourselves. It's a mirror to our society. It's a story of ourselves. But on the other level, it explains to the rest of the world. I mean, the book's coming out in 13 languages, which is phenomenal. 18 countries so far. And it explains to the rest of the world that this is who we are as Filipinos. This is why we are the way we are. These are the challenges we're facing. And it also reacts to all these preconceptions and misconceptions that Filipinos are just domestic helpers and Imelda Marcos and the guy who shot Versace, right? And we're all of those things proudly, but we're so much more. And that's what I hope to accomplish partly in my own very, very small way with my work.
Okay. Rossi?
Yeah, your book...
Rossi, wait for the mic.
Both a privilege and a burden to read. A burden because for me, I get stuck in the beauty of your sentences.
Thank you.
For example, you said literature is an ethical leap, is a moral decision, a perilous exercise in constant failure. Literature should have grievances because there are so many grievances in the world. So let us speak freely because we are all peers here. Your grievances with me are because you say I have failed, though I only failed because I extended myself further than what any of you have ever attempted. So can you explain how you come up with these words? Where do they come from? Have you been a poet before? I mean, it's just so lyrical, and it almost sings to me when I read your novel. So it's just a joy.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like
joy.
That. That's, thank you. Well, those words were words of Crispin Salvador. He was giving a speech upon receiving an award back home in the Philippines, and he had become a very embittered man. So, I mean, in a sense, you know, it's my character talking. Where do I come up? Yeah, I mean, I started writing because I failed out of my economics major in college. And they said, well, you know, we're going to kick you out of Ateneo and send you to La Salle. Sorry.
Ooh.
If
end up in YouTube. Huh?
Yeah.
Careful.
If it's a rival school, we always make jokes about them. If you don't find a major, so I chose English Lit because I liked reading, and the path of least resistance. You're in college, you want to chase skirts and beer, and my thesis, my senior thesis, came along, and they said, well, you know, what you have to do either an academic or a scholarly or a creative thesis. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write because that's easier. Little did I know it was very difficult, and I started writing poems. So yeah, okay. I found that girls like poets. And yeah, so that's how I started.
Great. Yes. Gentlemen.
Could you comment on what you think the status of the Philippines is compared to the power structures, China, India, Brazil, United States?
Oh, that's a tough question, sir. I'll try my best. Thank you. The Philippines is, you know, it's a very sad case in the sense that we used to be the tiger economy, the dragon economy even, of Southeast Asia. After we were given our independence in 1946, we were leading the way. And little by little, all these other economies overtook us. And we just devolved into this pattern of patron, client, politics, and corruption. So much so now we're considered the sick man of Asia. We can't get ahead. Aid seems to go nowhere, line the pockets of the politicians. And we see places like India, China. They're just shooting ahead of us, whereas once we were the ones who were the bright rising stars. And in terms of importance, you know, we were always hoping to be as important as we always were when Marcos was you know, the Americans used to say, you know, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. But we no longer have that prestige, if you want to call that. So we have Gloria Macapagal Arroyo now, who's trying to position us as a key component of the war in terror in Southeast Asia. But, you know, who knows how true that is, and whether or not they're just trying to get the bases back, or, you know, geopolitics, basically. But, yeah, we're in bad shape. And next week we're electing a new president, and we're hoping, we're hoping to elect a new president, I should say. We're trying, but there are all these issues of whether or not
Do you discuss politics? I mean, do you have a candidate?
Yeah. Yeah. Manny Pacquiao.
All right.
I was thinking. But, I mean, it's a choice of, you know, the worst or the best out of the worst. We have six presidentiables. And unfortunately, you know, we have the one who I believe has the best chance and is the best person, Noynoy Aquino. I don't know how tested he is in terms of
experience
fighting the deeply entrenched corruption in the Philippines. So in the Philippines, we know where we want to go, but I don't know if we know how to get there. That's the thing. We know that we have to fight corruption. We have to fix the infrastructure. We have to fix education so that people have livelihood. We know all of these. Everybody agrees on this. But the question is, how do we get there? So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's sad, and yeah, it is sad.
Any other questions? Yes. Can you wait a while? Hang on.
Hi, my name is Alex. Do you believe like in revolution in your country?
It's funny, you know, I mean, when I first started this book, I really started reading a lot about communism, and I thought, well, you know, it's the rich from which, you know, and the privileged and the educated class in the Philippines from which I come and many of my friends do, are really, you know, they're not doing anything, and maybe, you know, a revolution is necessary. And I had to work through that. And one of the things I worked through in the book were these ideas. And I don't think, just as Crispin said, that, you know, it probably won't be that sort of revolution. it will be something very small, initially, grassroots, step by step, as we address the problems we have, corruption, patronage, all those different things. So a violent revolution? No. We've had three people power revolutions and counting. You know, I remember the first one watching it on TV. I marched in the second one hoping that Arroyo would be our bright shining star. She went to school with Clinton, you know, I mean. But she wasn't, and she was just as bad, if not worse, than all of them. She's the longest serving president after Marcos, our dictator. And she hasn't done anything except steal. And so we need some sort of revolution somehow, a social revolution, but not something violent. I think a grassroots thing where we come up from the bottom and we empower the people rather than expect to decapitate the top and install somebody new, because that's we've tried that before and it hasn't worked.
Thank you.
Thanks. We can sing the Marseillaise after.
Yes, in the back.
Hello. Who are some of your influences, literary or visual or whatever? Favorite books?
Sure. I mean, wow, that's a long list. A lot of Filipino writers. Nick Joaquin, Bienvenido Santos, Carlos Bolosan. I was fortunate to study under Envion Gonzalez, our national artist. Marianne Villanueva, who's based out of California, was one of my professors, Jessica Hagedorn. So I take a lot from Philippine literature in English, but, you know, I read a lot of international fiction. So Saul Bellow, Hemingway always brings me back to the line and the sentence and details. Nabokov, Jorge Luis Borges. It's clear, I think, when you read the book, you see all these influences. Roberto Bolaño recently is an author that I feel a lot of affinity with. I read him after I finished the first major draft of Ilustrado, and he heartened me. His work made me feel like I wasn't so crazy doing what I was doing. But I also listen to a lot of music, watch a lot of films. The work, as I said, has all these recurring themes over over these disparate, linear, and separate narrative threads. And in a sense, you know, I think of music, and when you strum several notes, it becomes a chord. And all of these recurring themes to me are like motifs in jazz or classical music. So when I set out to write this, I said, well, you know, I mean, if this works in these different art forms, maybe it'll also work in fiction.
Two more questions? Yes, and then we'll catch you. Carol.
Hi. I was wondering where the title Ilustrado came from. Obviously, Salvador was from that class. It seemed to me that Miguel Cihuco, the character, was either from that class or aspiring to be of that class. So I'm wondering where the title Ilustrado comes from. And to follow up is also the issue of the way it was written is from an Ilustrado viewpoint, if we are to be collegial here. And,
sure.
And it just struck me as something that it came from a vantage point of an Ilustrado because of mainly because of the way the earning character is portrayed as crass and his descendants and Boy Bastos and all that, so...
Well, I mean, thank you. Yeah, okay, so two parts. First of all, you know, you write what you know, and you write what, at least in your first novel. And I came from a very comfortable background. My father's in politics. I went to, you know, an exclusive school. But, you know, that's not any less valid or authentic as a Filipino story. It's just one aspect of this very multifaceted story that is the story of ourselves. And nobody up to this point had written about that. You know, again, we're all we have in the 1960s and 70s, we had this move towards nationalism and patriotism and writing in Tagalog, or, you know, and being poor, raising our red books and being Marxists. And that was a reaction to colonialism and neocolonialism that followed after our independence. And I think that that's a problem. That's been a problem in Philippine literature for a very long time, because nobody wants to read. We've been doing that for 40 years, and are we publishing a lot on the world stage, even though we have an English literary tradition that's a century long? No, we're not. So I thought, I'm going to write authentically from my own perspective in the Philippines. And tear it apart, satirize and show how ugly and dirty and messy that is. Because I'm ashamed of in many ways, of what that class has done. There's that sense. The Erning Isip is a young, crass character in the book, but you also have to remember, he rises up and becomes a businessman and becomes rich. So we have that cycle of the rich, the poor becoming rich, and then, you know, constantly being overtaken by the others. So there's that element. Now, ilustrado refers to, in translation, means enlightened in Spanish. And there are three connotations to my title, ilustrado. It refers first to these young men who in the late 1800s, these Filipino men, went abroad, Spain and Europe, studied all they could, liberal ideas, arts, military strategy, etc., medicine, returned to the Philippines with everything they learned, and were an integral part of our Philippine Revolution, where we ousted the Spaniards. And because this is partly historical fiction, that's what it refers to. Second, ilustrado has come to connote all of the elite, these people who were educated, who had the opportunities. But because the book is an indictment of how the elite over the generations, over the past 150 years, have failed the Filipino people, it becomes ironic. They're not as enlightened as we think. And the third connotation is I try to rescue the term ilustrado from this calcified idea of these historical men in history 100 years ago, because we have Filipinos living abroad now. We have 9 million registered Filipino citizens. We have 4 million Filipino Americans living here. The Philippine diaspora is a huge one. But of those 9 million Filipinos living abroad, only 500,000 are registered to vote for the Philippine elections. And so in a sense, they've turned their backs on the Philippines in the single most important way they can, vote for our leadership. And I wanted to play with this idea that Filipinos now living abroad, learning all they can, just like those ilustrados of 100 years ago, are a potentiality, rather than the term ilustrado. To be enlightened is the potential of all of these Filipinos abroad to learn all they can and then come back somehow, or send back ideas, or somehow create some sort of social change. Right? So I wanted to rescue ilustrado from history and make it live again as something we can all be.
Do I have time for one more, Justin? I think the gentleman's hand was up before you. I'm sorry.
I can do two more. I don't mind. I'll keep it short. Yes or no?
All right, yeah. Quick.
True or false?
This will be short. Just piggybacking on your comment about Manny Pacquiao, it's almost inescapable to mention Manny Pacquiao and Filipino and make the two mutually exclusive. But Filipinos seem to be, at least from a pop culture standpoint, seem to be at an uptick worldwide. The world's most popular pop group has written two songs in the language. Mm-hmm. You know, we've appeared on Oprah twice, and there are 5 Filipinos playing in the NFL. The whole point here is, what does all this mean for you as a writer? I'm wondering if you could comment on that, if anything.
Well, no, I mean, I've always been proud to be Filipino, but I believe that being Filipino should be defining and not limiting. And I think all of these Filipinos who are making it on the world stage have come out of their shell and competed, not just in the Philippines or not just in the Filipino-American community, but have competed on the world stage. There's an old joke, how many Filipinos does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 15, right? One to change the light bulb, and 14 to tell the rest of the world that the guy changing a light bulb is Filipino. And there's that sort of closed-minded parochialism that I think we need to get beyond. I mean, I'm proud to be Filipino, and I'm proud of all of those, my kababayans who are doing well. But, you know, they're doing well as themselves, as artists who happen to be Filipino.
Quick question, and then...
Are you writing another book? What's the title, and what is it all about?
Wow. I am writing another book. I don't have a title yet, or I can't tell you because then it'll get stolen. But just as Ilustrado mimics other different forms, this one is told, it's a celebrity expose. So it's a bodice-ripping sort of celebrity tell-all about a young woman who becomes a presidential mistress by sleeping her way from the very bottom of Philippine society to the top. And through talking to her lovers and talking about her lovers, we get a cross-section of the different forms of power at play within the Philippines, and by extension, all the other societies. So every character represents a different form of power, traditional politics, religion, sexuality, celebrity, money, power of having nothing to lose, power of the people. And in that way, I'm trying to explore a society, Philippine society, but every society in that sense. So, I don't know, I'm working on it. We'll see how it works.
I think at this part, we have to close because...
He was the man who published my first work. He was the first person who believed in me on that level. And, you know, he was a great writer. So, yeah, I wouldn't be here without him. Yeah.
Good.
So, thank you all for coming.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.